On this episode of At Altitude, the Air Force is finding ways to expand the capabilities of its airmen. We sat down with Air Mobility Command's Major General Gerald Donahue, Director of Operations, Strategic Deterrence, and Nuclear Integration, to discuss how airmen are finding ways to advance and maintain airlift strategic advantage.
The opportunity to serve with Airmen and Air Mobility Command is a privilege and an honor, and it's exciting every day to see how they react to every challenge we throw at them, and there's no shortage of challenges we ask them to solve. So it's enthusiastic and inspiring every day.
That's great to hear. let's just jump right in, sir.
Yeah.
So I looked at your bio, and I did some math, which I'm not super great at, so feel free to tell me if I got this wrong, but it looks like in May you're going to celebrate 30 years as a graduate of the Air Force Academy.
I was hoping you wouldn't bring that up. It's another reminder of just how old and how quickly time, you know, moves. I graduated from the Air Force Academy in 1995 and had the privilege to serve principally in mobility assignments throughout my career. It has been an extraordinary journey. And I think about some of the formative events over the course of those 30 years, and there's no shortage, certainly, but the ones that really stick out for me were my first assignment. I flew C-9s doing air medical evacuation. That's one of AMC's core missions. And to be blunt, I think it's the most heartfelt mission we do. It demonstrates the commitment the Department of Defense, the Air Force, make to every single service member, every single service member's family, that at a time of particular crisis, we will spare no expense or effort. We will put everything in to make sure we get them to the level of care they need. And so that was particularly formative for me. And beyond that, you know, later I transitioned to the C-130, went to the Weapons Instructor course to learn how to integrate the C-130 as well as other mobility platforms into the overall air picture. That was particularly exciting as well, to be able to do that and be a part of that. I had the opportunity to command at multiple echelons, a squadron, group, and twice at the wing. And each one of those days, I tell people all the time that there are certainly hard days in command, but there are no bad days in command, because every single day airmen lift you up and inspire you with just how they respond to the challenges and the crises and how they lift each other up. And it's, you know, those were all wonderful assignments.
And how would you say all that experience has affected your philosophy on leadership?
You know, what I've witnessed over my career, in fact, I had the opportunity to talk with someone yesterday who is pursuing command opportunities, and you know, it's reinforced me that there are two immutable laws of leadership. The first one is it's a contact sport, right? You have to meet airmen, you've got to meet soldiers, sailors, Marines, Guardians, you got to meet them where they are and get out on the line with them. And learn what they're doing, how they're doing it. They may be the expert, but you can certainly learn from them and get a better sense for the challenges they face. The second is that leadership always is a team sport. I deserve very little credit for anything that my airmen have accomplished. They are absolutely extraordinary. What the unit does is a product of their work. And then, of course, relying on each other is at across echelons to support and move the effort forward. And so those are the two things I pass and have helped shape me as those two, what I refer to as immutable laws of leadership.
You have a ton of combat and combat support flying experience, over 4,600 hours. How has that experience influenced your perspective on modernizing air mobility and airlift?
I think two lessons come from my flying experience. The first one is how the environment in which we operate our airlift platforms has become more complicated and changed over time. You know, when I first started flying, I mentioned I was doing air medical evacuations throughout Europe, always permissive environments where we were welcomed. Of course, as we went through the global war on terror, operating aircraft into what we would define as semi-permissive environments, and watching the cycle as adversaries seek to challenge our capabilities, and watching that acceleration over time, and recognizing that in order to be successful, you know, we have to up our game and be prepared and modernize our aircraft, modernize our crew force, so that the challenges as the environment shifts, that we can continue to deliver on the promise of rapid global mobility. I'd say the second thing, you know, what we experience as a crew force initially when in the aftermath of September 11th, when we began asking our crews to do things for which they were not adequately prepared, right? They needed to do things, the country needed to do things. You know, frankly, one of them is how we operated with night vision goggles very early in the conflict. And then you look at how we operate with night vision goggles now, demonstrative of or having learned from that experience, you know, and of course, what I spend most of my time thinking about is what skills will our crews need in the next conflict, and how can we prepare them now so that we don't ask them to do something unprepared. And so again, it's those two lessons that I've seen play out both through my own experience and witnessing the experience of my, you know, compatriots that shape my work today.
So I just want to talk to you a little bit about your role as the Director of Ops. I know it's a much longer title. but what is your role as the Director of Operations for Air Mobility Command?
So as the Director of Operations for Air Mobility Command, I exercise operational control of all of Air Mobility Command's forces on behalf of the commander. And what that essentially means is setting the operating environment so that we can properly employ rapid global mobility, right? So when you think about an airlift operation or an air refueling operation, it's just not about the aircraft. It's about setting the structure around the aircraft. In an airlift, it might be ensuring things are set in the aerial port of embarkation, at the aerial port of debarkation, any en route stops. For air refueling, it's the coordination with the receiver aircraft and all the elements that have to be in place for the large operations to execute. That's the focus of my team, right? Making sure that when things begin, that we are postured to execute at speed, at scale, that's necessary for success. You know, there's been countless examples of that over the last several years, you know, whether it's executing the presidential directed movement of munitions to Europe, or whether it's moving refugees from Afghanistan back to the United States. It's never only about the aircraft. It's about setting the enterprise correctly so we can continue to operate at speed and scale. Great challenges, certainly, and great lessons that we can apply towards any fight, right? And one of the things that we continue to learn is just how important the logistics element is to sustain operations over time, and how much work goes into setting that posture ahead of time.
Yeah, I don't think everyone realizes just how many people and how much work goes into even moving just one, say, C5 or C17, right? It's not just the maintainers who fix it, but it's the guys doing the planning, loadmasters, pilots, et cetera.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. You know, when I think about our strategic ports, those are power projection platforms. You know, we have several, both on the East Coast and the West Coast. We call them aerial ports of embarkation. And that takes an entire airbase to operate effectively, right? And having a commander who is focused entirely on the success of generating that combat power, just sustaining combat power through those locations, that is a whole of team effort to be able to support sustained operations. It really is inspiring when you see it happen.
How is Air Mobility Command integrating AFRGEN to ensure a rapid and flexible response?
So when we think about AFRGEN, it's about carving out time and space over a predictable cycle for sustained operations where units can get the experiences that they need so when we are ready to present them to a combatant commander, they can meet the full range of capability, right? And so the reality, we call it, there's the reset phase, the prepare phase, the certify phase, and then the available phase. It's in the available phase where we want them to be at the top of their game and ready to execute. Not just ready to execute single airlift missions, but able to operate as a body in a forward environment, in a contested environment. And so we, over time, over the last several years, have begun to adapt that along with the rest of the Air Force on how we present forces to the combatant commander. For Air Mobility Command, certainly it presents unique challenges because while we aspire to the attributes of each one of those phases of the aforementioned cycle, we cannot meet them in their entirety. Part of that is a consequence of the demand that the Joint Force has to employ rapid global mobility capabilities, both in campaigning and not just in crisis. And so that means that to a degree, even in a reset phase, our squadrons will be providing capability to U.S. Transportation Command. That's okay too, right? Because those missions that they'll execute, even in those separate phases of the aforementioned cycle, are used to develop them. It's just a matter of getting the balance right between when you're doing your high-end training and when you're doing your basic mission skill sets.
You know, we had the opportunity to go down to Little Rock the last couple of days and talk to some of the TAC Air guys. And when I asked them about Afrogen, I kind of prefaced it with, you know, you guys kind of, this isn't super different to what you were doing before. But they said one of the benefits is just knowing when they're going to be home mm-hmm. and be able to kind of rest before they start up the next phase. How important is that piece of it?
I think when we look at Air Mobility Command and the capabilities we provide, Afrogen manifests itself slightly differently based upon the assets that we're talking about. In our C-130 squadrons, our tactical airlift units, they forward deploy as a body presented to a combatant commander. Many of the ones out at Little Rock certainly have either headed to U.S. Central Command or recently returned from U.S. Central Command. But what it allows us to do is between those deployments do exactly what you talked about, carve out the time and space for them as airmen to cover down on their personal requirements, their families, professional development, any number of things, but also as units to train to those higher order skills in preparation for the next challenge. When I first got to Little Rock as a wing commander back in 2017, we were doing what we termed purple deployments. Right, and what I noticed about that is the entire organization existed to deploy the next individual. There was no time and space to develop a unit. We were focused on the next single airman out the door. While that sounds, all right, we are focused on preparing an airman, what we're losing in the process is the time and space to develop a unit. And so we transitioned ahead of the aforementioned transition to something that looks exactly like it, where it would be a unit pure deployment, and then that unit would have, at the time, about a year before its next deployment. And in that year, we tried to do the things that we talk about now as part of the prepare and certify phase. Now, when we talk to our C-17 squadrons, you know, that's our strategic airlift squadrons. That's where Afrogen rings differently. And again, it's because of the demand for strategic airlift capabilities throughout time in campaigning and not just in crisis. And so for the challenges we face by weapon system do certainly vary, and we acknowledge that and work with certainly the wings and the squadrons to do what we can to carve out the time and space they need to develop.
So I want to talk to you a little bit as your last assignment. You were the chief of the Global Operations Center at U.S. Transcom. How do you envision the integration of command and control systems evolving to support future airlift ops?
So, you know, the biggest evolution that we're seeing from a command and control perspective, and this is true not just for mobility operations, but for all operations, is how it will be contested and how we have to anticipate adversaries in the future will contest our command and control systems, right? So one of the very first thing commanders worry about is ensuring the command relationships that exist are good and are set correctly. And then beyond that, what is incredibly important is making sure that at the appropriate echelons of command, the skills and the equipment exists to exercise those command relationships. That's what we mean when we say command and control, right? They have the relationship, and then they have the capabilities to execute it. What we've seen, again, over the as the cycle of conflict continues and adversaries learn, is the efforts to contest our ability to exercise those command relationships, to contest our commander, our C2 capabilities. And that's not unique to, the forward environment, the theater environment, because of the danger that non-kinetic effects, cyber effects bring. You know, you could experience that back here in the homeland, you could experience that in route. And so one of the things that, you know, we have to do is harden our command and control capabilities. There's two ways to harden it, right? There's obviously to make more secure systems. There's also a way to proliferate the capability so that the enemy can't possibly attack all of it at once. And that should provide some capability. And that's what we have to work in over time with our C2 systems, whether it's hardening in the way I described our air operations centers, or updating the capabilities, the connectivity of our aircraft so that they can plug into the C2 structures despite it being attacked by, you know, a potential adversary. And so adapting that over time has been, one of our principal focuses. From Air Mobility Command's perspective, that connectivity, the degree to which we can connect our aircraft to the C2 structure buys what we term as survivability, right? Because it provides our echelons the ability to push the latest intelligence, real-time intelligence, changing battlefield to the aircraft in motion. And as a consequence, the air crew and the aircraft can respond accordingly. That's not something that Air Mobility Command and Air Mobility Command assets have enjoyed, you know, in my earliest days, certainly. You know, those were the days when you'd go to far-flung places and you were alone and unafraid. And if you were lucky, you could use a hard landline and call back to somebody if you needed additional guidance. But the nature of the threat has changed, demanding passing critical information much more quickly.
And obviously there's going to be times when command and control is just not, you might have degraded communications, you're not able to reach back to, you know, headquarters. How important is it to empower airmen to understand commander's intent and be able to operate without needing to reach back to headquarters in those situations?
Yeah, airmen being able to operate under what we term mission type orders or executing commander's intent is absolutely critical, right? I've witnessed airmen execute it well. Air Mobility Command does it well itself. When we do still continue to send aircraft commanders on the road with a general outline of what's expected of them and expect them to integrate and execute even if their connection back to the 618th, right? What was the last order you were given? Now you go execute. Right? So we've got the basic skill sets. The challenge that we'll continue to face with the rest of the joint force is, what does that look like when the period of interruption grows and it's no longer, you know, hours, it becomes potentially days? Which is why I mentioned that one of the things that we're trying to do is help strengthen and harden and disaggregate the command and control systems so the adversary can't attack it all at once, and so that there's a line back. But in the absence of it, you know, airmen, you know, are certainly extraordinary in their ability to execute off of commander's intent with their last instructions. And, you know, certainly I've witnessed it myself through various operations over my time. Frankly, you know, when I was in command of Al-Udeid Air Base during the summer of 2021, the Afghan NEO operation, the written guidance received was imprecise, and then using that to build commander's intent for our airmen and watching our airmen execute reinforced for me their ability to execute off of commander's intent.
Which technological innovations do you see as pivotal for maintaining airlift support superiority in contested environments?
Yeah, you know, I would say we're witnessing it every day, both in the commercial sector and increasingly in the military sector. Right, it's as the cyber domain changes and we move to the cloud and leveraging the cloud capabilities, so that we're not as reliant on infrastructure on our installations, right? We can leverage where the commercial sector has gone. And that it becomes, because it makes the most important thing for commanders at all level is going to be shared understanding. That shared understanding emanates from strong data, secure data, leveraging cloud technology so that we can continue to see the picture, even if, you know, if you attack, for example, a hard target like an air operations center. If the data is resident only at the air operations center, it makes it a particular vulnerability. But if you have the ability to disaggregate that air operations center and access the same data that's resident in the cloud and in server farms, global server farms, and backed up from server farm to server farm, you can reconstitute more quickly and shorten those periods of disconnection, if you will, right? And so that I think is what is changing most dramatically as we adapt what we're witnessing in the commercial sector for military operations. You know, the banking industry is a good example. That's another industry that is entirely reliant on the veracity and the security of the data. We all are, right?
Yeah.
We want our banking data to be secure. And so, you know, watching how they have adapted to the threats is important. And you look what cloud technologies have done for any number of digitally native companies in terms of infrastructure. It's much more challenging to transition to that than to build from the ground up. And that's what we're doing as a service, certainly as a Department of Defense. And it brings, in my mind, extraordinary resilience when done well.
How is AMC balancing the challenges of an older aircraft fleet while preparing for the demands of future operations? Right. And this is really front of mind for me, because I was just at Little Rock talking to them about how the C-130 just celebrated its 70th anniversary, and that's crazy, like, that we still are flying an aircraft from the 1950s.
Well, fortunately, in most cases, it's not the same aircraft from the 1950s. You know, we've gone through several upgrades for the C-130. I'm old enough to say I've flown E's, H's, and J's all, and the C-130J does represent both some of the traditional capabilities that the C-130 brings, but emboldened by new technologies. And a good example is its connectivity that it brings, whether it be beyond line of sight capability. Again, when I started flying the C-130s, the only beyond line of sight capability was, frankly, an HF radio, and not the strongest beyond line of sight capability, certainly voice only, no data capability. And now a C-130J with 8.1 upgrade maintains SATCOM capability, and so data and voice beyond line of sight, making it an integral element in a future fight, right? In a future battlefield network configuration, the ability to not only tap into it, but add capability to that battle network. And so with the C-130J, you see, a great blend of traditional mission capability with new technologies, and it's got pretty good power too when you compare it to the former ones. But you see that in a lot of ways, right? What we're trying to do is, many of our missions haven't changed extraordinarily. When I say that, what I mean is a C-130, or we still need a platform that can move cargo, that can move people, but do it in a more secure fashion. And so we still need the attributes of a medium transport. We still need the attributes of a large transport with a C-17, but we've got to make sure that it has the tools to survive in the future fight, from defensive systems to connectivity that empower and accelerate the capability that the weapon systems bring. We're bringing on board now, we continue to bring on the KC-46, another example of an aircraft that shares similar attributes of its predecessors in the KC-10 and the KC-135, but new technologies at the same way. And a lot of those technologies are in the form of connectivity and survivability systems as it continues to execute that critical mission. We're still compelled to think through new tactics, techniques, and procedures to employ, our assets as they exist, and that is a constant dialogue as we adapt, and the adversary adapts, and we adapt, and so that is just an ever ongoing cycle.
What role does innovation play in sustaining advancing Air Mobility Command's mission?
I would say innovation is critical. You hear that a lot, so I'll characterize it in a couple ways, right? There's two types of innovation. Tactical innovation. When I talk about tactical innovation, I'm talking about taking the weapon systems we have and figuring out novel ways to employ them. And it's fun to witness that from the line, right? When you go to a place like Little Rock and a squadron is tackling a tactical problem, and it has the resources that has already been assigned, not additional resources, but then to watch the incubation that naturally occurs. And they go, if we do it this way, we increase our survivability or our effectiveness. And, you know, we are reliant on that tactical innovation because, you know, I think it was Secretary Rumsfeld at one point had said, you go to war with the army you have. Well, what makes that army survivable, or in our case, what makes our Air Force survivable, is that tactical innovation that occurs, you know, at that need. Separately, there's, you know, the technological innovation, right? And figuring out as technologies are presenting themselves that we hadn't imagined, you know, probably the most stark example today is the way proliferated low Earth orbit satellites, you know, Starlink, are changing the way we can connect in the beyond line of sight space, and adapting our aircraft to be able to tap into the PLEO is a game-changing innovation led by the commercial industry. When we thought of satellites in the old days, and frankly, they were large, they were expensive, and they were limited. Now, when you think of satellites, they're small, they rapidly iterate, and they're going up by the thousands, right? And so when you think about that, that presents opportunity because, as we talked about before with diffuse command and control systems, the enemy, the adversary, might be able to attack a low Earth orbit Starlink satellite, but the ability to attack them all is certainly unattainable, right? And so that ensures the survivability of some of that connectivity we are reliant on. And so adapting to leverage that new reality, if you will, that with the reality that technical innovation has brought, and then you know, the demands it makes on us, and how do we use that capability now?
How does working with allied and partner nations enhance global air mobility and interoperability?
I would say working with our allies is one of our greatest strengths, right, for a variety of reasons. More of them than not, our allies have a better understanding of the local situation than we do. And that understanding and helping to prepare for operations and shape operations is critical, just to have a better sense. They bring unique capabilities sometimes where we don't have them. They certainly bring capacity where we need additional capacity. You know, we couldn't afford the military that we need to defeat adversaries single-handedly. But when we combine our efforts with our like-minded allies and partners, it's certainly an achievable outcome. So our allies bring knowledge, they bring capacity, they bring unique capabilities. A good example, you know, I like to think about is on the airlift side, right? We have C-17s and C-5s, extraordinary strategic airlift platforms. We've got a C-130 as an extraordinary tactical lift platform. And then some of our allies and partners bring the A-400, which is right in the middle. We can't possibly afford all of the infrastructure necessary to get to that middle capacity, but our allies and partners, you know, are perfect in bringing that to the overall airlift fold, if you will, when we think about what's got to be moved. That's just a simple example of where they might have capacity and capability we don't, but doing it as a team is certainly the preferred method.
And how important is it to exercise and train with our allies and partners?
So, you know, if you don't prepare to operate as a coalition, you will fail when you attempt to operate as a coalition, right? It's like anything else. You know, if you field a team and you never practice, then in any sporting activity, you're probably going to lose. And war is really no different, right? And our ability to execute our missions when we prepare and exercise means that we are going to be able to operate as a team. And so we look for those opportunities. This summer, we've got the next iteration of Mobility Guardian 25. We just finished one a couple years ago, Mobility Guardian 23, and working with our partners and allies, both in their spaces, if you will, in the Pacific region, and then integrating their capabilities at echelon from our airframe capabilities, integrating all the way through the command echelons is a critical element to bring these operations together, these exercises together, right? It provides real-time feedback, relationship building, insight into each other's strengths and weaknesses. I couldn't be more excited to execute Mobility Guardian 25, and it is certainly a more fulsome exercise because the allies and partners are present.
How is AMC leveraging data analytics and AI to optimize airlift ops and decision-making processes?
I think we're seeing this everywhere, right? The value of data and then analyzing that data. There's a number of ways we're trying to leverage it. One is a better understanding of resource utilization, or where the stress points are, air crew readiness, predictive analytics, if you will, for when we think aircraft might require repairs. Our counterparts in the A4 and the sustainment team use that capability. So, I mean, there are a number of different use cases for us. As we transform as an Air Force, collecting data and then over time analyzing that data to figure how we need to adapt our training programs. A good example for me in this space that we're instantiating here within AMC and the A3 is, you know, how we make a pilot has changed over the course of my career, right? When I went to pilot training, it was very structured and understood, and I could still tell you, you know, what that looked like. Today, as we've modernized pilot training and leveraged new learning capabilities, the time it takes to create a pilot and the skills they get are different. And as a consequence, we're tracking performance after they graduate pilot training through their aircraft commander upgrade in our weapon systems, so that we can invest in areas we need to shore, and we could leverage areas where we appear stronger than we anticipated, right? And that is only enabled by the collection of data and then the analysis of that data. And of course, artificial intelligence, machine learning help us analyze data at extraordinary speed that would take humans much longer, and we would be less adaptive to. So that's just an example, but it's replete across the organization.
So we've already talked a little bit about the importance of large-scale exercises like Mobility Guardian, and how they help identify and bridge potential gaps in joint training. I'm curious if there are any lessons that have been learned from recent ops or recent exercises that are helping shape what the future exercises are going to look like.
The most important lesson that I think we can take from recent operations is the necessity to rapidly set the enterprise for large-scale movement. One of the things that has occurred over the course of my career is the balance of U.S. forces present overseas versus present in CONUS has markedly changed. Today, we have less permanently forward forces than we did in 1995 when I graduated the Air Force Academy. And as a consequence, the demand for us to rapidly deploy CONUS forces has increased over that time. Right? We demand the ability to rapidly move our forces forward. The nation demands that. That doesn't happen with just aircraft. We've got to set the structure and the stages across those lines of communication to be able to sustain. A good example would be when we think about the aftermath of October 7th, Hamas attack into Israel, and how quickly we had to push forces to reinforce U.S. positions in the U.S. CENTCOM area of responsibility, and also to provide support to our partner nation. The demand for airlift to do it, because of the speed that airlift brings, was extraordinary. But you can't simply throw more planes at the problem if you don't ensure the in-route locations are prepared to receive and turn those aircraft. What does it mean by preparing a location? It's ensuring that there is maintenance presence. It's ensuring that there are additional air crew so that the aircraft can keep moving even when the air crew times out. It's ensuring that there's fuel present. And so the lesson that we continue to learn and learn more completely is just how important it is to quickly set the enterprise so that it can sustain the speed and scale. We saw it with the NEO out of Afghanistan. We saw it with in the immediate aftermath of the Russian invasion of the Ukraine. We saw it in the outcome of, or the immediate aftermath of the Hamas attack in Israel. And, you know, we see it in our exercises as well. We've got to set that enterprise fast. We've got to set that enterprise early in order to sustain the joint force.
What is Airlift's strategic advantage?
So when we think about rapidly moving or maneuvering a force, what Airlift brings is speed, right? Not necessarily mass. When I from my Transcom days, I'll tell you that a large medium speed roll on roll off ship carries about 400 C-17s worth of stuff. You know, when you think about scale, service lift brings scale and size. But when you think about airlift, you're talking about speed. And so if there's a crisis somewhere, anywhere, the immediate call comes to strategic airlift to move the capabilities. It could be in response to a humanitarian assistance requirement somewhere. It could be moving, as we did for the wildfires in Hawaii, moving critical capabilities to the island. It could be in response to the fires in California, moving equipment to the region. Airlift brings speed and it brings flexibility. We bring it at scale, right? That's what Air Mobility Command does for the nation. It brings that the speed and the flexibility to rapidly deploy capability, rapidly deploy the joint force at speed and scale. That's its strategic advantage. And it's unique, and the size that we execute it is unique to the United States.
I was just about to follow up with, when I think of mobility and specifically American airlift, you know, whether you're talking about the Afghanistan evacuation or years ago going out to the Philippines for the tsunami recovery type, right, hurricane recovery type stuff, there's no other organization in the world that can do what American Airlift does.
That's exactly right, right? Air Mobility Command is the nation's rapid global mobility. And it's our asymmetric advantage. You can't point to another nation in the world that can do it at the size, at the speed, and at the sustained pace that we can.
Is there anything I should have asked you that I didn't, or anything you'd like to add or talk about that we haven't already?
I just want to thank you for the opportunity to brag on what our airmen and Air Mobility Command do every day. It is truly inspiring to watch. It helps me sleep at night knowing that regardless of the crisis, there's a crew force, there is a institution that is ready to deliver for its nation, whether it's moving combat capability, humanitarian capability, or moving service members or their families back for the care that they need. Knowing this organization continues to thrive is what helps me sleep at night. So thank you for the opportunity to brag on it.
At Altitude is produced by the staff at Airman Magazine, a publication by the Defense Media Activity. You can find all our stories at airmanmagazine.af.mil.
Radar contact out of 7,000, 13, 16,000.